Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Transformers Rise of the Beasts, The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster, Shiny Happy People, and a look back at Tales from the Dark Side, the movie. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Renfield. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news I want to hit is the box office. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse did unprecedentedly well, almost double the expectations. I heard people going into this were thinking $70 to $80 million for the weekend. It ended up making $120 million plus for the weekend. That was grossly underestimated. And to top it off, the original Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, the first one that came out like 5 years ago, I think that made like in the $30 million range. So, I mean, this is 3.5 times what the original film did. It is a fantastic score for the Spider-Man movie. And as you recall, I was a little lukewarm on it. There were some things I thought were imperfect, but boy, this thing really clicked. And what it's showing is that there's some changes going on in the animation. I mean, the other big animated film isn't even a Disney movie this year. It's the Super Mario Brothers movie. So you have these two films, one from Universal, Super Mario Brothers, and they've done big movies in terms of animation before because they got the whole Minions franchise. But this is from Sony, and Sony's had kind of a touch and go when it comes to animated films, and especially considering that Disney had two really big, high-profile flops last year in terms of animation, Lightyear and Strange Worlds, which I think have their own reasons for it. And no, it's not because they were woke. Lightyear, I think, flopped because nobody knew how to fit it into the franchise. And it was an inherently a boy-weighted movie. And those tend not to do well. You kind of have to get both boys and girls into the theaters. And I think Strange World, it's just, nobody knew what that was about. And it was brand new. And there was nothing to hang your hat on with that one. So Little Mermaid suffered a 56% drop, which isn't terrible. It's not doing as well as the other live-action adaptations, but part of that's overseas markets. I think here in America, it's over $200 million going into this weekend. It's doing well. It's just, you also have to look back at the original Little Mermaid was not a box office juggernaut. It did very well for animation in 1989, but it doesn't even hold a candle to stuff like Aladdin and The Lion King in their initial runs. And those tended, of course, to do well in the remake versions. And The Boogeyman came in third with a somewhat tepid $12 million, which was not very good. Now, the next piece of news I want to talk about is something that's bubbling underneath the surface, sort of a film Twitter type thing. And it goes back to the stuff of changing and editing films that exist. Now, we heard all about this with books, like with the Dr. Seuss books, a couple of them being pulled from print that nobody reads anyways. Not Cat in the Hat or Green Eggs and Ham, but stuff like McGillicutt's Pond. Or the Roald Dahl books getting some massaging treatments in their new publication. I think this is for different reasons, but it's hitting the same chord with people. The movie The French Connection, the award-winning 1970s cop movie, apparently somebody noticed this. It was not announced, but somebody noticed that the edit's different in, I think it was on Vudu and it was on the Criterion channels. There's like 9 seconds that are removed. There's a 9-second scene where Popeye Doyle is talking to his partner and throws a couple racial slurs around. And it's apparently been edited out of the existing streaming content. And the only place that you can get the unaltered version is now on Blu-ray, which is out of print because everybody went and bought it. And the thing is, it's because it uses the N-word in there. But it more confounds me as to why they would edit this, because it's The French Connection. No, nobody's showing that one to kids. Kids would be bored to tears with a movie like The French Connection. So I don't know why they're adjusting. I mean, I understand why you'd adjust, like, Roald Dahl's books, or even the James Bond books, where you're trying to get new readers all the time. But why are they changing The French Connection? But what I found fascinating about it, and I think this shows exactly why they're doing it. Somebody was complaining about it. Somebody wrote an article online, and they're talking about the scene, and they have a clip to the YouTube clip, and you can see the 9-second scene in YouTube. But then they start explaining what's in there, and they use, in the dialogue, a slur for Italians, which the guy posts on his page, but then he blocks out the N-word. And I'm like, well, this is, if you're not even going to publish it on your WordPress document, and you're doing it for political correctness, then no wonder they're thinking about adjusting it. Like I said, I don't know why they're adjusting an R-rated movie from the 70s, but they are. But it reminds me of this little bit on a John Mulaney special. It was called New in Town, which he did, I think it was for Netflix several years ago. And he talks about trying to put a somewhat taboo word into a bit he was writing.
I was once, I'll tell you this, I was writing for an awards show once, and I got into some trouble. I wrote a joke for this awards show that had the word midget in it. And someone from the network came down to our offices, and he said to me, hey, you can't put the word midget on TV. And I said, I sure would like to. And he said, no, midget is as bad as the N-word. First off, no. No, it's not. Do you know how I know it's not? I said to him, is because we're saying the word midget, and we're not even saying what the N-word is. If you're comparing the badness of two words, and you won't even say one of them, that's the worst word.
It's the same thing. You have somebody who is trying to point out how terrible something is, and in pointing out how terrible it is, they're avoiding saying the very thing that the studio is now trying to avoid having put out there. And I think that just shows when you deal with the longevity of pieces, and it's not the first time somebody's edited a movie for sensitivity. I mean, there's a lot of versions of Holiday Inn out there that have completely cut out the blackface scene. And you'll see that a lot. They did that with a lot of, there's episodes of Kids in the Hall online that depends on where you watch them. If any of you watch them on Amazon Prime, you get the original version, but on IFC, they added out some blackface stuff. They add out some language for that is considered offensive to homosexuals. Now, even though it was Scott Thompson doing subversive comedy at his time. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to go into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is Insidious: The Red Door, which is coming to theaters on July 7th.
Our family has been through a lot together.
You told me that when I was 10. I was in a coma, but I don't remember being sick.
We're ready to forget. Forget.
Ever since then, I see crazy stuff in my dreams.
Those are not dreams. It's happening again. Something is following us.
The further you travel, the riskier the journey becomes.
I like the Insidious movies. This looks good. It looks like it's an uptick from the last Insidious movie. The third one was kind of a mess. So this should be kind of fun. I never understand the horror movies in the summer. Those are hit or miss. It's not a great time to release horror movies, but they do a lot. The original Insidious came out in September. And this one seems to be a bad time to release it, but I'm looking forward to it. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Good Omens Season 2, which is coming to Prime on July 28th.
The Archangel Gabriel has disappeared.
I think he's gone to Earth.
Hello, hello, hello.
Good morning, officer.
Exactly. I'm a human police officer.
It's just Aziraphale.
The traitor.
And his grumpy friend, Mr. Crowley.
The demon.
Oh, I suppose that explains the grumpiness. Oh, and of course, his assistant.
Hi there.
Ah, Gabriel! What's he doing here?
I don't know.
What's happened to him?
I don't know.
I was a huge fan of the first season of Good Omens. I love Michael Sheen and David Tennant. I think they do a great job. I'm very curious to see what they're going to be doing with this one. Jon Hamm in a comedic role is also great. So I'm looking forward to both of these, and we'll be seeing them in July. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be taking a look at the Amazon documentary, Shiny Happy People.
Shiny happy people, holy, shiny happy people.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the reviews. And the first one I'm going to do is Shiny Happy People, which is available on Amazon Prime. And I know it came out last week. I had a hole in this week's schedule. And I was like, let me check out that Shiny Happy People. I generally don't cover documentaries or reality TV or those docu-series or mini-series, mainly because there are so many of them. That's an entire whole genre that I'd have to add to my plate. But this one was getting enough buzz, and I'm sort of fascinated with the story anyways. Not only did I decide to cover this, but then I watched it, and I said, this is going to take me, I'm going to talk about this for the whole segment, because there's a lot of deep diving that can go into this. In Shiny Happy People, this expose into the Duggars family and its influences shines a spotlight on criminal behavior.
There's a story that's going to be told, and I would rather be the one telling it.
TLC created a PR show.
You've probably heard of the Duggar family.
Everyone knew who the family was.
We were part of IBLP as early as I can remember.
The biggest feature of Bill Gothard's teachings is authority.
Kids obey the parents. Wives obey their husbands. Everyone obeys Bill Gothard.
Gothard turned every father into a cult leader and every home into an island.
I did not know the religious side to the Duggars. I mean, I knew that they were from Arkansas and I knew that they were a Christian family, blah, blah, blah. But I never really knew how pervasive their religion was in the show because I never watched the show. I hate reality TV for the most part. Whether you're talking about the Trading Spaces type home renovation shows or you're talking about everything from Kardashians on down. But my wife watched it back when it started. She also watched like John and Kate Plus 8, and she was fascinated by it because at the time we had two young children, and then we had a third that was coming on the way in 2008, and we co-parented quite a bit. I stayed home with them. She works as a teacher, but I know how hard it is to wrangle two or three kids. I couldn't imagine over a dozen. And that's, I think, her fascination with this, because she'd say, oh, they plan this and they do this and this is how they manage it. Now, I also come from a big family. My grandfather had 13 brothers and sisters. Two of them died either very young or as babies. I think one might have been stillborn or something like that. But if you include the ones that never really made it into childhood, he had 13 brothers and sisters. So I know what it's like having a very large family in your background. Now, they were just coal miners in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, right on the border. It was not a religious thing that they were doing. It was just that's kind of how families worked back then. I mean, we're talking the early part of the 20th century and a very rural section of Pennsylvania and West Virginia. They worked in a household and like the older girls took care of the younger kids. And so I know what that's like to come from that culture outside of the religious side. So my wife really never told me about the religious stuff because that's not what interests her. She is interested in the child stuff. So after all the scandals and everything that came out of it, it was interesting to watch this series because it dove into their life, the Duggars as a family and what they did. And there's a lot of focus on their religious side, mainly because that was the infrastructure that created not just their family, but their family structure. And that was sort of the point of their church. And this was what I found so fascinating because it was exactly that power structure. And they pointed out and they go through it and they explain it, how that power structure from almost like a cult-like leader who then created mini cults in every household that he influenced, that's how they work. And it is cult behavior, because one of the things that cults do is they isolate people. And that's what they did. They isolated the children and the family from everybody around them, homeschooled them, never let them interact, only gave them material from them. They couldn't watch TV, couldn't read books outside of what was approved. And it was really this church, and a church in quotes, because it was this organization called the IBLP. I'm not worried about speaking out against the IBLP, because if you're part of the IBLP, you shouldn't be listening to this program anyways, because I'm here talking about Transformers movies, for crying out loud. But that entire organization had this power structure and this money structure, and it preaches stuff like prosperity gospel, which is nonsense, it's harmful, it's inherently unbiblical. There are entire books written in the Bible about how just because you do the right things does not mean that you're going to be prosperous. That is literally against some of the writing in the Bible. And that kind of culture fosters this culture of judgment and power and opens yourself up for abuse because there's no accountability. Oh yeah, you have accountability to God, but I don't see God coming in and stopping the abuse in a church. But it's a fascinating look at how power and abuse works. And when you allow people to get away with stuff, even the small stuff at the beginning, because all the stuff about Josh Duggar, I mean, that guy's a monster. I'll say it right out there. He's a monster. I don't care. I think you have a clip of Mike Huckabee getting mad at an audience member or journalist asking him about his defense of things. Like, well, I know the family. I'm like, if you know the family, then apparently Josh Duggar, this was chronic behavior for him. And it's really just horrible to watch this story and the real victims in there. So as they're doing the show, you know, they do a lot of interviews with Jill Duggar, who's one of the girls in the family who was molested by Josh. And there's even a scene where they bring it up to her and they bring up to family friends and they're all like uncomfortable about it, as you should be. But I'm like, well, you know, they're going to ask about these questions because, I mean, Josh Duggar's in jail right now, as he should be. But that's what is so fascinating about it is how even in this interview, she has trouble calling her brother out. And that shows how pervasive the cult-like behavior is. Because here's the thing, they're tied into this church and the Duggars as a family were making so much money off of this. And Jim Bob had it set up that he got every, you know, the kids didn't get anything. And you look at the video and you can tell the kids, they're always very nice and polite. And you gotta worry when kids are too polite because kids need to be kids. And that was one of the, oh, the kids are so well behaved. It's like, yeah, because they've broken their spirit. I mean, I have very well-behaved kids, and they're grown up now, but I've had very well-behaved kids, and people would compliment us when we were out in public, but we had chaos at home, too, because they were normal, but there was this fake veneer of a reality TV show, which has nothing to do with reality. And it really showed how this power structure starts in the home and how it protects, in particular, the men in this culture, because when there's this much money involved, you got to be careful about something that makes loads of money, because if it's making tons of money, there's always a chance for corruption and not honesty. I don't make crap doing the show. So, which is why you should listen to me, because at least there's an honesty here in my reviews. But it's horrifying how the power structure of this church, I'm not saying all churches at all, because there's a lot of good churches that do a lot of good. But as evidenced by what happened with the Catholic priests brushing that under the rug and trying to take care of it themselves and just making the problem worse and spreading it around and not removing the rotten bad apples, just moving them to a different barrel so they infest more. I mean, people are out there upset about drag shows, making laws against that, but nobody seems to care that you have a group like the IBLP having this infrastructure that not just provided an opportunity for abuse in the worst way, but then they protected each other and insulated each other and allowed that behavior to become systemic. Like the girls that were molested, like, oh, I know a lot of people that this happens to. If you know that many people who've been molested, then you are in a bad, bad, bad situation. So that's what I found so fascinating about Shiny Happy People. You can't trust everybody to give a truthful look at themselves. So I'm going to have to say, you know, it's a terrifying look into a manufactured system of power, money, and abuse. And this docuseries totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Transformers, Rise of the Beasts, and the Angry Black Girl and her monster. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the actual theatrical releases and talk about Transformers Rise of the Beasts. In 1994, a guy from New York City teams up with alien robots to stop a planet killer from wiping out the galaxy.
Unicron is coming.
Becca!
Oh, I thought we were boys.
You brought a human here.
I'm nobody. I ain't even seen nothing. I'm not even seeing anything right now.
This is not our war.
Optimus, we must trust each other to protect the home we all share.
How big can this guy be?
He eats planets. So, like, way bigger than a planet.
So, I'm not a fan of the Transformers movies. I never have been. Ever since the 2007 one, the very first one I thought was okay. But they've just gotten louder and stupider as they've gone on. And a lot of that is because of Michael Bay. And now, Michael Bay, look, I get it. He delivers the spectacle. And his Transformers movies have some wicked cool action. They really do. But they are also all bloated and stupid. Can we just agree on that? I mean, I know there are people out there who just love Michael Bay. I love the spectacle. But you watch these movies, and then there's also this weird, like there's a whole discussion in one of the Transformers movies, I forget which one, about Age of Consent. And I'm like, why is this an ostensibly a kid's movie? There's some weird stuff going on in the Michael Bay, some weird, creepy, sleazy stuff going on in the Michael Bay movies, but he's been doing them forever. The best Transformers movie was Bumblebee, which came out a couple years ago, didn't do as well as the others, but it actually had a coherent story, and it actually had a human story to it, and I thought that one was actually quite good. It didn't do as well, so they're like, no, let's make more explosions with Michael Bay. This one's not directed by Michael Bay, so already right there, that's a step in the right direction. And because of that, it is a mercifully less than 2 hour running time. Because some of the Michael Bay Transformer movies, they're all like about 2.5 hours. One of them is 2 hours and 45 minutes. Look, there's no excuse for that. Lawrence of Arabia earns long running time. Transformers Farts in the Wind does not, whatever the heck that last movie was. So, I mean, okay, on one hand, the Transformers movies do deliver the spectacle, and this one does. And this, the director of this, he does give you the big explosions and you get the action and it goes on and on and on. And yeah, that's cool. I mean, at this point, it's like almost it's not hard to make a Transformers movie because the technology has got to the point you can just animate whatever you want. And so it looks cool, but it's still absurd and stupid. I think the thing that helps this movie is it's a much leaner story. Like the Michael Bay movies, the scripts have got to be 200 pages long for those movies. And there's no reason to. They have these long drawn out dialogue scenes and discussions that make no sense. And it's like they put together a hodgepodge of terrible scenes and terrible dialogue and never edit anything out. And that's why you get these bloated movies. This one, at least the character scenes are pretty simple. And it's not hard to follow. Heck, I got him and I even dozed off a couple times in this movie. I don't feel like I missed anything. So this film delivers on what it needs to. But what I do like about it is it doesn't deliver more on the stuff it doesn't need to. I mean, we do not have a long, deep dive into these characters and their discussion and their motivation. You have very simple stories. Like Anthony Ramos plays this guy who's taking care of his brother who's got, I think he's got sickle cell anemia, and he's trying to, you know, help out his family. And his reason why he needs to stop the bad guys is because he just wants to save his family. And there's a woman, Dominique Fishback. She's like an assistant anthropologist at a museum, but her boss kind of takes her all of her credit, and she's helping them find this artifact. And they're fine characters. They're completely passable for a Transformers. They're not as egotistical and beer commercialized as like the characters in the Michael Bay movies. So they don't lather on too much into their story. So it makes it easier to get through. But I've never been a big fan of these. So yeah, I mean, if you just want giant robots blowing stuff up, you get that in spades. There's still a lot of that. And it is as loud and bombastic as the other ones are. It's just you'd have to sift through less garbage to get there. I mean, it's more coherent than the garbage from Michael Bay, but it's still a noisy, overblown mess. So I'm going to say that this version of Transformers is better than a lot of the other ones, but it still kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the angry black girl and her monster. This is in theaters this week. I believe it's going to be on demand and on Blu-ray later this month, and then it's going to be on Shudder. In The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster, a twist on the Frankenstein tale, this modern horror story follows a traumatized girl who tries to bring her brother back to life.
Your daughter has a very disturbing obsession.
What obsession?
Death.
Just think about your brother.
didn't have the chance to bury him. Just wish I could catch who took his body.
Death is the disease that broke my family. I'm sick of seeing it.
The Mad Scientist!
This is actually based on Frankenstein. I mean, it says it's based. I mean, it's not just inspired by, but it's a different story. And I've read Frankenstein, too. I love Frankenstein. It's a great book. And one of the things I respect about this is it does play off. I mean, most people think of Frankenstein as, you know, the giant tower with the monster going up there and what they see in the Universal monster movies. But the original book is a lot more in depth, and the book contemplates life and death and morality. And this one really struggles with some of those questions as well. So I respect the heck out of it for actually mining some themes out of Frankenstein, and rather than just having a big hulky monster go in and scare villagers, which is kind of what Frankenstein turned into in the Universal Monster movies. But it is very much aimed at a black audience. And it deals with issues that, not to say that, you know, inner city and crime are black issues, but it's definitely playing around with archetypes and story elements that can be conceived and perceived as an issue for a lot of black people in this world, because they're dealing with drug deals and they're dealing with crime and violence within the family even. And it sort of puts it from a perspective of this girl. She lives in this somewhat rundown community. There's drugs and there's crime in there, and her father's on drugs. Her mother had died, and her brother was part of gang membership, and he got killed during that, and she then of course steals his body and wants to bring him back to life. But she has a scholarship, or she goes to this really nice school, but it's her facing prejudice on that end. And I know that's a triggering thing for some people. I mean, you probably, if you're going to get triggered by that, you're probably not going to go watch a movie of this by its title alone. But it is trying to give that perspective. And I can respect that, because the reality is Black America loves horror movies. And this is one of those horror movies by Black Americans for Black Americans. And I know it's weird for me to say that as a big fat white guy on radio, but I can recognize that. And while I may not culturally click with everything that they do in this movie, I can respect the movie for what it is. This presents an interesting take on a classic with a nice dose of dread and suspense. There's some real scary, creepy, nerve-ending moments in this film. I think that it's extremely well done in building the tension and building the dread and building the scariness. I did enjoy this. I liked what they were doing for horror movies and the element that they were trying to put into this. It's effectively done. It has a lot to say. It is taking a very old story that's over 200 years. I mean, the original Frankenstein was published in 1818, and they are building it to a new interpretation of it. I love the way they play around with it. Now, sometimes it seems a little bit awkward because it does adhere as much as it can to some of the story ideas in Frankenstein. But I think it gives a really interesting mix. So, yeah, I'm going to say that the angry black girl and her monster kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, looking back on that classic, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Renfield. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on to finish the movie reviews. And I want to go back into the past. I want to go look at an older title, and that is Tales from the Dark Side, the movie. This anthology film presents tongue-in-cheek horror stories from Stephen King, Arthur Conan Doyle, George Romero, and Michael McDowell.
I warned them, but they wouldn't listen.
You promised you'd never tell!
That cat has killed three people in this household.
I don't believe this.
Kill it, bury it, and bring me its tail.
Tales from the Dark Side.
Well, that just about takes care of that, doesn't it?
I have always loved anthology movies. I mean, going all the way back to the old Amicus movies from the 70s, they did stuff like the original Tales from the Crypt and the Vault of Horror. That was a British studio. And they did a bunch of these very short, and they were cheap little movies, but I love those anthology movies. And then even stuff like Asylum, those were short films. And there was one called And Now the Screaming Starts from the 70s as well. I don't think that was a traditional anthology movie, but it had different segments to it. There was the old TV movie called Trilogy of Terror with Karen Black and the little, it was like a little like monster doll that was coming after her. That was an anthology film. And it reminds me a lot of Twilight Zone. I love the Twilight Zone. I love the old Alfred Hitchcock series. I love anthology TV series. Recently, I've been getting into, I noticed it's on Peacock. I don't know why it's not on HBO Max or Max, because it's an old HBO show. But it was called Ray Bradbury Theater, which is an anthology series of his short stories. And as a kid, I remember when Creepshow came out, I begged so much to go see Creepshow. I was like 10 when it came out, or 11, and my parents took me. But I mean, it was bloody and gory, but I loved Stephen King. I loved George Romero, even at that young of an age. And I wanted to see Creepshow, and I loved Creepshow. Creepshow 2 was kind of a bit of a bad one. But then they did this movie, Tales from the Dark Side, in the 90s. There was an old series called Tales from the Dark Side that was syndicated. There are a bunch of these anthology horror shows in the 80s and 90s, stuff like, well, they redid The Twilight Zone and they redid Alfred Hitchcock Presents. But in the late 80s and into the 90s, they had like The Outer Limits was on Showtime. But there were the syndicated stuff like Tales from the Dark Side. I think there was one called Monsters. They had Freddy's Nightmares, which was kind of an anthology type story. There was the Friday the 13th, which is kind of like Warehouse 13. And Tales from the Dark Side was very, very cheap. They weren't great stories, but they were fine, disposable, low-budget horror movies in the flavor of Creepshow. And apparently, Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, was originally going to be a third Creepshow movie, but I think they had trouble with the rights or whatever. So they made it into its own thing, and they branded it as Tales from the Dark Side. And there's three main stories in a wraparound story. And Debbie Harry played the character in the wraparound story. She's basically a witch who's going to roast Matthew Lawrence. You know, he was a little kid at the time. And he's reading a book, and so he's trying to distract her with his stories. And each story, like one of them is an Arthur Conan Doyle story. One of them is from Stephen King. One of them is from Michael McDowell, who did Beetlejuice. And I think the wraparound story is by George Romero. This also fell into that tongue-in-cheek horror, the somewhat humorous horror stories where they're sardonically funny. I mean, these are still violent movies. It's R-rated, and there's some very adult stuff going on in them. Like, one of them is about a gargoyle that kills people. Another one's about a cat that hitman is trying to kill. That's the one. That's a very Stephen King-type story. One of them is about a guy who resurrects a mummy. And it has some people early in their careers, relatively early. Steve Buscemi's in it. And Julianne Moore, very young Julianne Moore, before she became really well known in the 90s. This is a really neat movie. I mean, it's a little bit goofy at times, and it's a little bit silly, but I had a lot of fun rewatching it. I hadn't seen it in years, and I forgot how good it was. Cause, you know, sometimes these anthology stories can be pretty bad. Like Creepshow 2 was pretty bad. But this, as an extension off of the Creepshow concept, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was surprisingly well put together and, very, very fun. It was a clever and sardonic continuation of the Creepshow style. I mean, even more than the Shudder series Creepshow, which is out now. I love this little movie. I wish they made more of this. I wish these movies did better and could have launched more of a franchise, but they struggled to really find an audience, and I think they were just a little ahead of their time. So, Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, which you can get on Prime right now. And I'm going to say Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Renfield, which is coming out on Blu-ray and DVD this week. This, of course, got a lot of buzz when it was first advertised, because Nicolas Cage plays Count Dracula, and it's the second time he's played a vampire type story, because of course he did that infamous movie Vampire's Kiss, where he really isn't a vampire, he just thinks he's turning into a vampire. Vampire's Kiss is not a good movie. It just has some great scenes in it. But in this one, he plays the actual Count Dracula, and Nicholas Holt stars as Dracula's servant as he tries to break free from his control.
My boss, he's different.
You can't get him out of your head.
No.
Renfield.
Bring me innocent victims.
Some call me the Dark One. Others, the Lord of Death. To most, I am Dracula.
Okay, obviously we're dealing with a little bit more than just narcissism here.
This, very much like Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, is a very violent, visceral horror movie, but it's also got its tongue in its cheek. And that's good. I can enjoy that. Horror tends to do well with a certain degree of comedy, as evidenced by something like Cocaine Bear, you know. This is the kind of movie, it did not do terribly well in the theaters, but I have a feeling it's going to live online more. I think this is the kind of movie that people can watch together and at their home, and it's going to live as this cult film. It's not there yet because it just came out a couple months ago in theaters, but I think there's going to be a lasting love for this movie because of it's not quite mainstream humor to it. And that's really what makes the movie work. That's kind of what makes it kind of a beautiful movie. Your average people who want to watch a horror movie, they don't quite know how to process a film like this. One of the things I love about it is also it's beautifully shot. In this day and age, there's so much I've complained about, that murky, naturalistic lighting where everything looks like they light. I just saw a movie. I won't tell you what movie it was, but I just saw a movie this week that they literally have people on screen and a giant spotlight behind their head. You can't see any details of the people's face. That's the new way of shooting movies. Renfield doesn't do that. It's very well lit. It's neon colored because it takes place in New Orleans. So they lean into some of the color palettes that you'd have from some of the very stylized stuff. I've never been to New Orleans, so I don't know how accurate this is, but I've seen stuff like, you know, in the old, Nightmare Before Christmas, how Oogie Boogie is sort of all under black light and you have these, skeletons in the dancing makeup. That's the kind of lighting that it evokes in a movie like this. So it looks fantastic. And Nicholas Holt carries the movie, and he plays it with such this almost this childlike innocence and naivete for somebody who's over 100 years old. And of course, you know, Nicolas Cage completely chews the scenery and other people's faces throughout the movie. So I found it a lot of fun. It doesn't take itself too seriously. It's very violent, but the over-the-top crazy violence is meant to be silly. So it's not a visceral, terrifying horror film, but it works for what it is. And I had a lot of fun with it. Now, I mean, the Blu-ray, it comes with like alternate takes and deleted and extended scenes, and of course a spotlight on Nicolas Cage. So there's a couple special features in there that are worth checking out. But the real reason to see this movie is for the movie itself. It's a lot of fun. And I was so disappointed to see the reaction of people in general when this movie came out. But when it comes to horror movies, historically, for a horror comedy like this, these things normally don't click with the mainstream audience. They usually don't make a lot of money initially. And that's kind of a good thing, because that shows that it's going to probably have some longevity and legs going into the history books. So I'm going to have to say, I really enjoyed Renfield. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
And that's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about The Flash and Elemental. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.